My name is Edward Champion, and this is the Bat Segundo Show. Now, before I moved to Brooklyn, I lived in San Francisco for 13 years, and God, I loved it. Frank Chew, barbecue at the bottom of the hill, Polk Street, the dogs that ran through DuBose Park, the burritos, oh God, I miss them, the Salvadorian restaurant that had this magnificent soup, the notebooks at the Blue Danube, the Mint, the Castro, look, the list goes on. But in recent years, between the private buses and the unaffordability, well, I've become quite concerned about what San Francisco has transformed into. That is an unidentified woman at Molotov's, this wonderful punkish bar in the Lower Haight that I spent quite a lot of time in when I lived in San Francisco. And she's complaining about this woman named Sarah Slocum, who is filming her using Google Glass without her permission.
And we were there maybe about 15 minutes. And two girls that were there, they started showing a lot of animosity towards me because I was wearing Google Glass.
That's Sarah Slocum, a woman who could not seem to understand that videotaping people isn't exactly a method to ensure that strangers buy you drinks or they set you up with their wonderful, sexy friends.
I walked up to the bar just saying, like, oh, Google Glass, like, you know, just negative kind of comments.
Negative kind of comments, indeed. What does a scenario like this say about the way in which the world is moving? Why are we so drawn, so compelled to document every single moment of our existence, to videotape it? Well, we're now at a point where it isn't just government or the corporations willing to spy on us who reveal all the details. We're perfectly happy to give away every minute for free. Why is this? Well, I met with journalist Julia Angwin, author of Dragnet Nation, to see if she had any solutions to this regrettable predicament. As it turned out, Julia is just as much enslaved to convenience as the rest of us. Okay, so I'm here with Julia Angwin, who is most recently the author of Dragnet Nation. Julia, how are you doing?
I'm great. Great to be here.
Great to, yeah, we're actually in a room. I don't think we're being spied on right now, but that we actually, well, we do have our phones.
You know what? First of all, we have our phones, and I'm sure there's a camera here somewhere.
Well, anyway, let's start off and look at this from a historical standpoint. I mean, between J. Edgar Hoover's harassment of dissidents in the early 20th century and the American Protective League, a volunteer organization during World War I that spied on persons unfriendly to the government, with the exception of technology that enables spying to be done faster, the so-called Dragnet Nation that you identify fits in with this regrettable American tradition. There's a wonderful book by Jay Feldman called Manufacturing Hysteria. I'm sure you're familiar with it. That's a good overview of this. What makes any of the post-9/11 developments any different?
Well, what we have post-9/11 is we have better spying technology, first of all. And so basically, and it's cheaper. So we have a much bigger dragnet. And that's why I called my book Dragnet Nation, because we see this new kind of surveillance, which is vast, computerized, impersonal, right? You're not a suspect. You're not even a customer of the company that's tracking you. You have no relationship anymore with the person who's spying on you. And it used to be spying was hard enough that although there are many regrettable incidents of spying on the wrong people, it still took effort on the part of the spies to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, yeah, you mentioned, of course, there's the Stasi comparison to the NSA, which we'll get into in a little bit. But I'm curious about this. I mean, you get into the relationship between privacy and behavioral economics quite a bit. It seems to me that there's a voluntary impulse on the part of most Americans. You bring up experiments from Carnegie Mellon professor Alessandro Acquisti, where people are less willing to pay for privacy when they don't already have it. You also bring up Dan Ariely's irrational compulsion to keep doors open. I talk with him. He's a blast. When you try justifying why you, Julia, still have a LinkedIn profile. And one of the ultimate problems here is that, well, we have to be part of these services in order to get a job that will allow us to pay our rent and go ahead and feed our families. We have to use social networks to keep in touch with our family and our friends. So, you know, honestly, I mean, it seems to me that we're complicit in this devil's bargain. So what do we do? Is there a way to exist within this dragnet culture without giving everything away?
Well, you know, the thing is that you're right, that privacy is this very kind of confusing construct, right? No one wants to pay for it. No one really understands what it is. It's kind of murky. But the thing is that we're in a situation where I think what everyone can understand is the idea that you do want certain things to be within a certain channel. Like the way that you portray your day at the end of the day to your spouse is different than the way you would portray it to your boss, for instance, right? These are just very simple examples, but I think everyone can understand that not all audiences are the same. And so we're in this world where you really can't trust, though, who the audience is. It's most likely the whole world is your audience. And so that's sort of the fundamental psychological problem that we have. Now, when you talk about the aversion to paying for it, it's, as Alessandro has demonstrated, we are just unwilling to pay for things we don't have. And since we basically perceive that we have no privacy, we don't want to pay for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've had this experience in the past with the environment. We had a really dirty environment. We lived with a lot of pollution. Our rivers caught fire. Our air was filled with soot. And no one wanted to, quote, pay for that. And then as a society, collectively, we actually figured out ways to adjust that situation so that now we don't have as much rampant pollution. So we have dealt with similar types of issues
before.
But
we do have climate change and rising waters.
Yes, we did miss.
I hate to break it
to
you.
No, I know. I mean, the problem with the environmental comparison is, like, we didn't actually adequately capture all the threats. But, like, of the ones that we saw on the ground, like the rivers catching fire and the air being filled with soot, we containerized those. We basically said, okay, we're willing to live with a certain amount of particulates, but not our rivers catching fire.
So inevitably, in the question of privacy, it seems to me that we're going to have to find a compromise solution, if we find any solution at all.
Yeah, we're going to have to find, where do we want to draw the line? Right now, this idea, it's really kind of a wild west. I mean, on the commercial side, there's very few laws that regulate our commercial entities that collect data about us. And then as we've seen since Edward Snowden's revelations, that the government side possibly didn't have the oversight that people, you know, Congress was surprised at what they were doing.
Yeah.
And so both sides feel a little wild west.
Yeah. Well, you had mentioned just a little bit earlier about this idea of the fact that what we portray about ourselves online, our virtual selves, don't necessarily match our real selves. Is there enough in that to, I suppose, counter some of the problems of all this data scooping, of all the stuff that we are willfully giving up, of all of the search results that Google grabs, of all of the little details on Facebook that we share? Is there anything about that separation that that is positive, that might actually be used to fool the authorities who are happy to go ahead and scoop, scoop, scoop?
Right. Well, so when I did this book, right, I tried to answer the question of what can we do about it, right?
Yeah.
Exactly what you're saying, which is there something we can do to protect ourselves in this world of indiscriminate surveillance? And what I tried a whole bunch of strategies, and actually one of my most effective strategies was what you're describing, which is basically spreading disinformation about myself. And which, you know, sounds a little unethical, but
especially since you have a problem lying, as you say in the book. You've been very good about showing yourself as Ida Tarbell, just for the record. Yeah.
Right. So I did struggle with this idea of lying about myself online. And I went through certain steps to try to understand whether I felt that was ethical. And in the end, I decided that I was in a situation where what was being done, collecting all my data, was also unethical, and that this was my best strategy. And so given those constraints, I was willing to do it, but only within the legal limits. So I didn't do anything illegal, I would just like to point out. But I did create fake identities and spread disinformation about myself. And I did find that that was an effective counter strategy. I think the question we have to ask as a society is, do we want to live in a society where everyone is doing that? Because I think that is, unfortunately, not going to be pretty.
Well, especially since we promulgate the George Washington notion, I shall never tell a lie. Well, in order to actually have an honorable existence that isn't actually claimed by various corporations, we do have to lie now. And we all have to feel like a criminal. And that's just incredible.
Yes, right. So that's what that's actually what indiscriminate surveillance creates, is the fact it creates this thing where everyone says, oh, I have nothing to hide. But the truth is, there are enough laws out there that if everything is known about you, you have broken some law somewhere, and there is now going to be this opportunity for discretionary justice, right? You are in the crosshairs because you've spoken out against some government official, and that they will have an opportunity to find something on you.
Yeah.
And so we do have now this, we have the perfect tools for any bad politician who wants to do that.
We've only been talking for a little bit, Julia, but I have a feeling that you are someone who likes to stare into the bleak truth while maintaining some hope of optimism. And I'm wondering, you know, okay, let's say that most Americans are placed into this existence where they constantly have to lie and spread misinformation. I mean, what would that do to our digital identity, to our digital culture, to our national culture? I mean, is this a reasonable expectation of what the next 5, 10, 20 years will bring?
Well, you know, we did have, let me think about it, our life online and living in a world that's so mediated by, you know, all this technology is really new. And basically, in the first 10 years of it, it was so awesome because yeah. we were empowered as citizens and individuals and as consumers in ways that we never had been before, right? Remember the days when you had to call every airline to get a fare. Now, you know, they're all competing,
yeah.
right? And so we have, as consumers, really benefited from this. But the problem is now that the tables are turning, right? We had kind of our 10 years of fun.
Yeah.
Now the companies have got better weapons than we do, you know, and now they're going to spread, you know, just the same way that you've noticed it's harder to get a good fare these days,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And there's no one has proved it yet, but there have been so many rumors that they're, you know, they are tracking which fares you search for and then they lock it in at some higher price. And of course, that is technically perfectly possible, right?
Yeah.
And so even if no one's doing it now, somebody will. So the problem is the companies are going to start organizing and, you know, in their own way, spinning or spreading a little disinformation to shape how you behave. And then as a natural countermeasure, we're all going to start doing the same. Now, what this does is actually very similar to pollution, which is what I was saying before. It pollutes the common environment, right? The idea of the internet was it was this amazing place where we could all have equal access to the world's information. And it was incredibly empowering, and it still is. But the more we pollute that environment with propaganda on the company side and propaganda on the individual side,
yeah. Mutually assured disinformation.
It is mutually yeah. assured disinformation, and it's something that we have to think about as an environmental problem, I
yeah.
think.
Well, I mean, in light of that conflicting with all of the content one has to wade through, I can only imagine, I mean, is that really the answer, just to invade the digital landscape with all sorts of flotsam, much of it absolutely untrue, much of it prevarication? I mean, that's what we're going to have to do, perhaps?
I think that we may. I mean, particularly for children, right? So I particularly worry about my kids
yeah.
because the fact is, when I was a kid, there was no digital record of the 2 years that I decided to only wear pink and turquoise, right? No one has any memory of that. And it is not documented.
And you don't want anyone to have any memory of that.
I don't want anyone to have any memory of that. But today's children don't have that luxury. It will be there, right?
I think there was a month that I wore pink during that period too. So if it's any consolation.
Right.
Just between you and me. Oh, microphones. Yeah.
Right. It was a, you know, it was a moment in time where everyone was wearing pink. But I think that what I feel like they don't have the luxury of reinventing themselves or making mistakes and then correcting course without it becoming a part of their permanent record.
Yeah.
And so for my children, I'm actually very insistent that they use fake identities online because I think they should have an identity that they can discard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about some of this. I mean, we were alluding to how data is shared among various companies, and I want to get into that. I mean, Facebook and many other online services have this troubling tendency to just share our personal data with not just other companies, but also to be just utterly cavalier about how they present it to our friends. You bring up the case of Sean Lane. He purchases this diamond ring for his wife. It's supposed to be a surprise gift, and it's 2007. And all of his 720 Facebook friends see this purchase courtesy of Beacon. Google Street View, I mean, it begins by collecting Wi-Fi networks with its vehicles as it trundles through all the various cities, and now it's doing so through our Android phones and collecting a particular network which it can use for whatever nefarious purposes it may, even though the mantra there is don't be evil. So most people are not aware of this tracking, but what realistically could be done stopping short of wrapping our phones in aluminum foil, which is basically a poor man's Faraday's cage, huh, Julia?
Yes, well, I know you're alluding to the fact that I did actually wrap my phone in foil. Yes, it did work, but it was highly embarrassing.
Yeah. But now the black helicopter lifestyle seems to be the legitimate one. Yes. My goodness.
Right, so I did get a nicer, basically, aluminum case for my phone, so I'm not that far from the black helicopter. But I think that what I felt after learning so much about all the different ways I was being tracked and also about my very limited ability to control it was that it was essentially just deeply unfair. And what I felt that I wanted more than anything else, weirdly, was I wanted access to my data. I wanted to see it because the truth is, who's going to learn more from it than me?
Yeah.
I would like to know, you know, I think that I'm a certain type of person, but maybe if I tracked my movements and really carefully, I would actually find out that I'm not optimizing my life appropriately. And so what's weird about all this data is basically everyone has it except you,
right? Yeah, yeah.
And so I think the starting point should be we should be able to see our data. And also we should be able to correct it because people are making decisions about us based on this data. And if it's wrong, if we're on the terror watch list or we have a terrible credit score because of some incorrect data, we should have the right to fix that.
So we have, instead of disputing our credit through a credit agency, we'll dispute our terrorist status with the government. That's kind of a creepy position. Maybe they're waiting upon the technology to watch us as we go through and correct our reputation through all of the Google search data and everything else that we have put in, and then they can use that and sell that too. I mean, it just seems like it never ends. There's layers atop layers atop layers. I mean, is there any way to just kind of get the sword and cut the thread so that the it goes up or what?
Well, I really think it's about redress, about, you know, if you are harmed, do you have the right to some sort of redress? And to me, it comes down to that. If my children are pigeonholed and can't get a job because of something they posted when they were 8 online, I think that they should have the right to dispute that and say, I'm no longer 8, I'm 18, or, you know, and actually just this is how we do things in America. We basically fight it out in court.
It is fascinating to me that what one does 10 years ago, if it happens to be online, bears no statute of limitations whatsoever. I mean, and Google sometimes switches the algorithm so stupid things you put up like 10 years ago now reflect who you are now, and you're a totally different person, you know?
Yes, right. Huh. And so I think that we have to think about, you know, I'm not entirely convinced about the right to be forgotten, which is this European notion, because the truth is that what I also really don't want is, like, you know, sex predators who prey on children to erase their past so that then they become my kid's best friend and I don't know it, right?
Yeah.
So the problem is that cuts both ways.
Yeah, so it looks like you're on the other side of the fence with that particular thing.
Right. But I think that if we could have control of our data in some reasonable fashion, and if we were able to see how it was being used against us or for us, I think that would actually limit a lot of the harms that are out there.
But this raises an interesting question, Julia. I mean, if we believe in the right to privacy, does that mean we have to actually afford it to someone who is a sex predator or someone who is not a very nice person? I mean, don't we have to give it to everyone? Is that kind of part of the price we pay, just as it was the part of the price that we paid to have the convenience of these services giving up our privacy? I think it works both ways if you put the genie back in the bottle, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, that's the freedom of speech dilemma, right?
Yeah.
We have to let people say really terrible things. Yeah. And so privacy is a little different in the sense that I'm not advocating for anything more than just being able to see your data and have the right to know when it's being used against you. And so in that sense, you know, yes, bad people should have that right too, right?
Yeah.
So I'm okay with that.
Okay. Well, so let's talk further. I mean, even if people decide to opt out of Facebook or even Google, they're dealing with a situation in which these giants are still retaining all of this data, what we search for, what our social networks are, And all this, as we alluded to earlier, is better than anything the Stasi had, as Records Administrator Gunter Bormann told you. When you went through your Google search history and your tweets, your own curiosity at what this data revealed often trumped how it was being processed by these companies to construct a profile. And when you shifted over to DuckDuckGo, you observed how you became so used to the way that Google filled in the field with the next word of your search request that you actually had to adjust to DuckDuckGo language. Let's say that a sizable chunk of people do make the choice to use a search engine which knows nothing about them. How can they possibly beat the convenience factor and the backdoor data swapping when these giants are the ones who really hold all the power? And also this adjustment that I mentioned that you made from Google to DuckDuckGo.
Right. Well, so, you know, it's interesting. I wasn't sure I could quit Google search. I really thought, you know, I mean, to me, basically going online meant Google search, yeah. Right? They were synonymous. And as you mentioned, it was an adjustment, and I had to teach myself how to use a new service. And
it's the information smack dealer that rolls its way into your phone and your computer.
Yeah, but I realized, you know, it was so empowering to learn how to do it differently. And then I realized I can that was actually one of the few victories in my book where I was able to control my data. I was able to switch, and I get great results from DuckDuckGo because I've learned how to use it. And I actually think we all need to, in addition to the regulatory schemes I'm talking about where people may need to see their data, have some rights over it, I also believe we have to become more tech literate, right? Right now, what we're essentially doing is we're just taking whatever tools that are fed to us, right? Yeah. And we're not thinking about it. We're just using them. It's sort of like, you know, when they first invented canned food, everyone just ate canned food, you know? And then it occurred to people, like, you know, you don't have to only
botulism.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to only eat green beans in a can. They also grow, and you can buy them at the store and cook them. And I think we have to become a little bit more of like equivalent to the local food movement. We have to be a little bit more thoughtful about where did our technology come from? What is the purpose of the company that's making it? You know, makes a little bit more informed choices. The way that when you go to a restaurant now, you're like, was the cow happy, right? Before it became a burger? Because, you know, now we need to ask that about our tech tools. Like, who made this? Are they happy? Do they want to steal my data?
Look, I am absolutely with you. I would love to have the online equivalent of free trade coffee. But at the same time, 90% of the population is just going to go for the immediate convenience. That is such a compelling reason to use it because it's so fast. And so I don't know if there really is any way around this, especially given history and given that canned food is still very popular in supermarkets.
Not as popular as it used to be. Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting because
I'm in Brooklyn, so
you could you could say though that, you know, when Starbucks started, people would have said to them the same thing, right? Everyone is perfectly fine with their $1 coffee at the local diner. Why are you starting this $3 coffee thing, right? And then they made it into a huge business. And I guess I think that, you know, in our country, the great thing about capitalism is it's another way to vote, right? We can vote with our choices of technology, and we can promote a privacy-protecting market. This technology, some of the technology that's privacy-protecting is not as fast and not as good, but some of it's just as good, right? So you're not giving up that much.
At the same time, there is a fundamental difference between going out of the house and walking to the Starbucks when you actually have the phone right here in your hands and you could type it in immediately. I listened to there was a recent Radiolab episode where they looked into diapers.com and how they were able to go ahead and click a button and the diapers would arrive in like 3 to 4 hours. And they looked into what was behind that. And of course, you can imagine it was not especially pretty because, of course, warehouses, exploited workers, quotas, and all that.
Yep.
So if it's out of sight, out of mind, and if it's in your house, I think that's a fundamentally different type of convenience than anything we've had before. So what of that?
I think that's true. But also what's interesting about all this technology is because it's in your house, it's such an intimate choice. You actually are really invested in your choices because it's like you sleep with these phones next to you on the bedside table, most of us. And, you know, so they are, I mean, other than our spouses and our children, like we're basically in bed with this technology.
And sometimes before you acknowledge your spouse, you acknowledge your phone and get the hit. Yeah.
Right. So my point is, these are very intimate choices.
Yeah.
And actually, I think that makes us care more about them because we spend so much time with
care more as we unthinkingly grab the phone before we look at our lover in the face.
Right. Well, we care more about what's on the phone than our lover. So therefore, we should actually care what's on the phone. Right. So maybe you should have the DuckDuckGo app that you're looking at instead of the Google one.
Yeah. Or go to the lover first. you made efforts to live under a different identity using the notable journalistic nom de plume Ida Tarbell, which we had alluded to earlier. But when you sat down at your bar, the bartender knew your real name from your card, which prevented you from using your Ida Tarbell credit card. There's clearly the risk of Ida Tarbell being used as an alias and added to your data broker reports. So short of using cash and using a fake name, what can we do? I mean, how long can we continue to play these time-consuming games to resist the data brokers?
Yeah, no, it's not easy, right? So, I mean, I loved using my Ida Tarbell name. I have an Ida Tarbell credit card, and Ida Tarbell has a phone. She has an Amex card. She has an Amazon account. She's got a whole life. But honestly,
when she's not taking down Rockefeller.
Right. But you know, to keep this really going, what I should be doing right now is applying for four more accounts under different names and constantly rotating them. And that is like something that basically no regular person is going to do. Yeah. And even someone as obsessed as me is probably unlikely to do. And so it's not
bad enough keeping track of all your passwords. Now you have to keep track of your names too.
Right. So I did use one service that automated the name generation for me. So I found that I was running out of fake names to come up with. So I used this service called Mask Me that basically anytime you come to a website that just is random, you know, every random website wants your email address for some unknown reason, right? And sometimes it won't let you in without it. So this just generates a new one each time. And that I found was really helpful. And I mean, it may well be that there's going to be a new market out there for like fake name generating services. That might be another thing that we end up buying.
Well, I mean, on that note, I mean, there's one point in the book where you attempt to organize this birthday dinner party using encryption. And you send out the secret encryption to all of your friends. Only one of your friends was able to decrypt the message. You also experiment with new privacy guard to develop these encryption keys for your email. But even top technologists told you that it was too much effort to stave off GBG attacks. So short of going back to carrier pigeon, which I presume would be shot down by a drone, is there any truly reliable way of sending a message to someone without using all these services all the time?
It's hard. I actually recommend postal mail. You know, it is actually very secure.
Aside from the fact that they scan every single envelope that goes to the mail.
They do, but just don't put a return address. Then all it has on it is the name of the person it's going to, and then that's it, right? Yeah. So no, you know, until they get handwriting recognition really down, which they probably will. But the contents, they can't open unless they have a search warrant. So it's still one of the most secure ways to communicate. Now, it's not that convenient. I still think there are some types of encryption are really hard. The type that I used for my birthday party was one of the more difficult kinds because it's a one-time encryption. So you have to send essentially the code book and then the key and then the message. So there's three communications, right? So it was asking a lot of my friends and they did not meet the challenge. But there are types of encryption that everyone should do. Everyone should just be encrypting their hard drive. Macintosh makes it super easy, one click. You know, an iPhone, you can encrypt the phone, one click. Android as well, I believe. So I think that I definitely took all these experiments to the extreme, but I also believe that if everyone just did a little bit more, it would actually make a huge difference.
On the other hand, I have enough problems trying to go ahead and put in that capture code, but I leave a comment, just some sort of, haha, that was a great article or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, that level of hassle just seems to be increasingly part of our lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe, I guess the good thing we can say is that this will discourage people from going online because everything now involves this elaborate Byzantine process. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, is that really the future of online expression and online purchases, or
we're like in an interesting time, right? It's not just a privacy threat at this point, it's a security threat. So your data is not just being, you know, scanned by big companies and by big government. I mean, the hackers and the criminals and the other countries that are trying to attack us are also going and trying to get our data. So in fact, what's really weird about the world we live in now is that although we have obviously the Defense Department and plenty of people who are supposedly defending the nation. We are actually all sort of responsible for defending our own cyber terrain in a weird way. And so,
talking about stand your ground.
Yeah, right. But like, that's actually the fact of the matter is that that's now how hacking works. They just go around all the walls at the edge of the country, and they go find the one person who's willing to click on the stupid link to a supposedly funny video, but actually is spyware. And, you know, so we all have the strange burden of protecting the security of our machines, which is an impossible task. And yet, because there's no real defense other than that right now, we do have to become a little more tech literate just for our own security.
Yeah. Well, I want to actually bring up Tor, which I think is the first time I've ever actually brought up Tor in this entire run of the show. So thank you for allowing me to geek out like this. One of the common problems that you identify with services such as Tor is that these projects are built by grants and volunteers. I mean, Moxie, Marlin Spike told you point blank that there isn't really a market for consumer privacy software. So when you have something that is largely done in this kind of ramshackle way, that is often, as you learned when you were trying to use apps that were still being produced that you wanted to pay for, often there's no compatibility with that. I mean, you know, that also was a serious problem. Do we actually have to persuade the private market that this is something that people will pay for? Is that really the only way we'll be able to get people in this habit of protecting themselves and protecting their terrain, as you had mentioned in this last answer?
Right. Well, there's this huge challenge in computer security and privacy arena right now, which is that the most as long as we're going to geek out, I'm going to geek out a little bit here, which is basically to really get the most credit from the security experts, you need to build open source software, because the idea is that your code can be reviewed and edited by anybody. It's sort of like Wikipedia, right? Anyone can edit the code. Anyone can contribute.
I spend time in GitHub too. So.
Yes. And so the that provides the most verifiable security. That's the way that you prove to the world that your code is secure. It doesn't have a backdoor to China or to the NSA. And so that is the best way to build great security. However, profit-seeking companies are often reluctant to put their code out there. It's their trade secret. It's what they sell. And so so essentially, you have a lot of open source projects that are really funded by volunteers, and they can't maintain this stuff. Now, Tor, I would say, is actually one of the more well-funded ones.
Yeah.
So they have State Department grants. They have real staff. So so you have not seen the really...
But anybody using it still has to deal with that slow crawl, even when you used it as in a cafe with
yes.
your laptop.
So no, it's very slow. And for people who don't know what Tor is just basically a way to anonymize your internet traffic. So it routes your... The reason it's slow is actually not so much the fact that volunteers are working on
yeah,
it, but
yeah.
it's the fact is they're routing your traffic all around the world
sure.
to mask where you really are located, right? So you're browsing in a cafe. I was browsing in a cafe in New York, but it looked like I was browsing in Amsterdam.
Lithuania or something.
And that it actually is sending my traffic to Amsterdam,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is, by the way, a very slow way to browse the web.
Yes, yes. I mean, but the thing is if you had more money devoted towards Tor or towards something like that, maybe there might be a swifter way to anonymize
yes.
and a swifter way and to have a safer web browsing experience. That's what
yes.
I would sort of suggest.
Right. And I mean, I would say this, that one of the things on my privacy wish list is that, you know, Gmail could, in an instant, put in a perfect plug-and-play, completely seamless encrypted email.
Yeah.
If they didn't want to read your emails and put ads next to it. If they were willing to not know what was in your email, they could do it.
Yeah.
And so there are things that these profit-seeking companies could do and aren't doing, but maybe if enough of us want it, they might.
Sure. So last October, On the Media aired this fascinating segment where Sarah Abdurrahman, she and her family were detained for hours at the Canadian border by CBP. She made efforts to get answers as to why this happened, and CBP refused to tell her anything. In your book, you point to Yasser Afifi, a man who left this funny comment at Reddit over the deodorant ban being part of security theater at TSA screenings. And not only was he deemed a security threat by the FBI, but he found a bug attached to the undercarriage of his car with FBI agents bragging to him about what they knew about his life. So Afifi, I mean, he raises a lot of visibility with this particular story and about how far the FBI has gone, but he's now someone who lives a life where he doesn't take any chances. So, you know, this leads me to wonder, how can a Muslim American express herself in an age where even the most oblique suggestion of a threat is enough to get her on a list? This is a very serious problem and a very terrible one.
Right. And this is why I say in my book that one of the biggest problems with privacy is actually a First Amendment issue. It's a freedom of expression issue. In a world of total surveillance, how can Yasser Afifi say anything the least bit subversive? Because it will be captured, and then he will be monitored. And he found this thing under his car. And actually, it's worth pointing out, he didn't write the comment on Reddit.
His friend,
it was his best friend. And so the thing is, then he can't be best friends with that guy. So part of the sad story there is that that friendship fell apart because Yasser was afraid, legitimately afraid, to be hanging out with people who write subversive comments on Reddit, knowing that that would land him on an FBI watch list.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is not the world we want. I don't think that is the maybe the letter of the First Amendment is being followed there. I don't know that it's been challenged, but certainly not the spirit of what we think of freedom of expression, and particularly of freedom of association.
Yeah. Well, last week, I'm sure you're familiar with Reporters Without Borders and the fact that they issued their latest Press Freedom Index. The United States fell down like a bullet to 46th place, and Reporters Without Borders pointed out that this was one of the most significant declines throughout the world in the past year. You point to the First Amendment in this book as a negative right, and while we can be struck by the grandiloquence of the Laird versus Tatum dissent in 1972 that you point out, the precedents still stand. The Supreme Court still considers warrantless wiretapping as something that would not require judicial action. So do you feel that there's any real chance that the escalation of eroding press freedom will cause the Supreme Court to tilt its hand, that if it continues to encroach upon our lives or the lives even of, like, Yasser, that maybe there might be some way of challenging this at all? Or
it's hard. Right now, the Supreme Court precedents do not indicate that they are going to be receptive to this. However, I would say one thing that has been interesting. And after the Snowden revelations came out, the tech companies got really mad. And they said, look, the government, you are hurting us by not letting us disclose how often we've been asked for government requests for data about our users secretly. And we want to disclose that. And they fought, and they actually won, because the government was worried about their free speech rights.
Yes.
So this was actually a free speech win, which was the corporations were like, you know what? It's not fair to give us a gag order, to not be able to talk about the surveillance. And I think that cracks the door open, right? Which is like, okay, if they can talk about it, and then, you know, maybe that gives a leg towards more cases because then that opens the door for people to say, I know my data was sought. I think it was sought illegitimately. And before, you didn't know your data was being sought, so you couldn't challenge it, right?
Yeah.
So maybe there's an opening there.
I'm wondering if there's some sort of tightrope that, say, journalism is walking, where if they go ahead and stay away from the journalism long enough, there'll be the illusion of free speech. But if they can nab a few, they could sort of keep that 46th place in the actual index. Is that safe to say? I mean, it might be sort of a weird carnival act here to sort of create the illusion of free speech while simultaneously working up all sorts of methods to squelch it.
Yeah, I think that there is a huge challenge to press freedom right now. And I am very worried about it because the world of total surveillance is a terrible one for journalists, because we rely, as I'm a journalist, you know, we rely on people coming to us and taking risks by giving us information confidentially. And if you can basically never be assured that that information is really being transferred confidentially, then the source of information dries up. And I think that's actually the world we're in right now, which is that I myself cannot truly assure anyone that there's no way that they will be found out.
Yeah.
And 10 years ago, I would say that to sources, like, okay, then we'll meet in a parking lot and it'll be done. Or will you send it? Even then, it was sort of like, you send it to me an email, it will be fine. Now you can't assume that things aren't being monitored. And so that is a terrible situation for a country where I really believe the press is the watchdog of democracy. And I mean, if we're not there, keeping track, then what's going to happen?
Well, I know that there are certain outlets right now, especially ones that report dangerous news, in which, yes, they do actually not only have to meet in a parking lot, they actually have to meet in some place that has been preordained.
Yes.
You know, that's the, you have to go ahead and figure it out by code and don't bring phones. But even when you met Jacob Applebaum, you actually still had your phone in your purse. And so, this is actually incredible, because if that's such a kind of spontaneous, ingrained notion of putting your phone in your purse, then we're in serious trouble, because as Applebaum told you, you think that they're not actually, there isn't some spyware on your phone, you didn't take the battery out. So, are we going to have to get in the habit of taking the batteries out of our phones?
Yeah. Well, that was a big rookie mistake on my part, I just want to say.
Especially with Applebaum, yeah.
But
it's an understandable one, because we all do it.
Yeah, look, what I've been so surprised about is that no matter how paranoid I am, it turns out I wasn't paranoid enough. And this is what's sort of shocking, because I'm kind of, at this point, a professional paranoid. And so you would have think that I would have gotten, but in fact, I continue to be surprised. When the CIA guy went up on stage and said, we can turn on your phone remotely and listen to you, I really was blown away.
I also, the Applebaum speech at the end of the year, where he basically said that, well, guess what? The NSA can access any Wi-Fi or shut it down from 8 miles away. They're going ahead and encrypting the motherboards and all that, and they're going through the packages. It's really frightening stuff.
Yeah.
Well, short of tearing our battery out of our phones, are there any creative remedies within these severe limitations?
The phone is a very hard challenge. So that was the one I think I failed at the most, because as soon as I put it into that nice Faraday cage that blocks the signal, I also couldn't use it. So, it really, the thing about the phone, the entire reason it's useful is because it's constantly in communication with the towers and with your apps and with your, and so once you turn off that communications, it becomes a brick. And I really found that I couldn't solve that problem. I feel, though, hopeful about some of the other things. I managed to build better passwords. I managed to quit Google. I got off Facebook. I quit LinkedIn.
You gave your daughter also a special financial scheme on the password front.
My daughter set up a business building better passwords for people. She charges $1 a password.
That's something to get the free market types in your corner.
Right. So I did feel like there were some wins I had, but the phone was one of my biggest disappointments, and also data brokers. I couldn't get my data out of them. I identified more than 200 data brokers, and only 90 of them even offer an opt-out, because there's no law saying they have to.
Yeah. So what do we do? Do we sit there and take it, or do we raise hell in the streets?
Well, I am an advocate of raising hell in the streets, because I'm a journalist and that's what we do, although we mostly raise hell on paper and
online.
Online. But I also, I really believe that if people could vote by making better, smarter tech choices, being tech literate, even using encryption badly is a vote in favor of encryption, and it alerts, it's a metric that they can say, like, oh, all these people are encrypting, they must care about privacy. And that will actually, that does make a difference.
So market choice really is the best remedy at this point, because you've got Congress in gridlock.
I mean, look, I'd be happy if Congress would do something, but I'm saying in the meantime, why don't we start voting with these other measures we have in front of us?
Well, Julia, it was a pleasure to chat. This was a very wonderful time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.